Now, the TJ Smith Podcast, WBAL.com and the WBAL radio app.
Essential Baltimore City employees forced to work in unsafe conditions. That's what Baltimore City Inspector General Isabel Cumming found on July 16th after visiting 9 DPW facilities.
From what you saw at the various site visits, are DPW workers working in acceptable conditions?
No.
Why?
Because some of the conditions are intolerable. Because it's hot. Sometimes it's dangerous.
It is such a contradiction to have a code red declared by the city and have workers working in unsafe conditions. And we've seen kids go to school in unsafe conditions as well. And we're talking environmental factors like heat and air conditioning. Welcome back. TJ Smith here. Good afternoon to you all. That was Tali Taylor's reporting. And that was also the voice of Isabel Cumming, the inspector general. We had her on our show a couple weeks ago when this report first dropped. We also had her this morning with C4 and Brian Neiman as she's talking about this. And we all should be concerned. You know, it's interesting because we have to appreciate DPW workers. If you go back and look at New York, when the New York sanitation workers went on strike, that is one thing you get resolved quickly. You don't realize how quickly your trash piles up until they ain't collected it. That's when you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. What are they negotiating for? That's reasonable. Make it happen so they can come out here and do this job. To think that they don't ever get breaks. They didn't take the pandemic off. They didn't get to work from home. They weren't calling you and said, hey, yeah, put your trash in this receptacle at this location. We'll get to it when we get to it. They were still coming around. And to think situations like this where they're in conditions where they don't have air conditioning in their vehicles, they don't have air conditioning in the offices, they don't have clean running water, they don't even have bottled water, they don't have ice, they don't have gate, whatever. It's incomprehensible. And what makes it more frustrating to me is when we talk about the bureaucracy of what our government currently is. And when we talk about 15 different council positions on top of course, just the layers of government that already exist, how does something like this happen and then persist even when you have an inspector general and their report and they're making pop-ups and you don't seem to take it serious enough to ensure that whatever the issues were taken care of so that if a pop-up happens a week from now and you could show that it's being addressed. It's incomprehensible. And, you know, I pride myself in having been a blue-collar worker for most of my career. Is this white-collar work, Kevin? We call this, what is this? Is this white? I got a white-collar job now? I don't know. I don't get hot in here. I don't get cold in here. The temperature's pretty good, you know, it's regulated. So I don't have to work in the elements, you know. Every now and again, a producer might come in and have an odor or whatever, but that's a different story. But the people that work in these environments deserve to make sure they have what's necessary to help them navigate through their jobs and healthy. And the issue I have, if you think about the overall concept of the job of the inspector general, waste, fraud, and abuse, right? And you might look at this and say, where does it fit? It's probably more of in the abuse area of an employee. But, and I know it's not abusive overtime, but the issue here, when we talk about waste, fraud, and abuse, and just reckless spending, things like that, that goes under the waste, if any of these workers ultimately have some sort of medical emergency that's attributed to the conditions in which they're working in, it's going to cost us money as a city. And you can actually avoid that by investing in them with this, that, and the third. And that's seemingly what's missing. Here's more.
As temperatures spiked across the city throughout much of July, with the city health department issuing multiple code red extreme heat alerts, the inspector general says the DPW's efforts to respond to her concerns were inadequate.
I won't ever just listen to what someone tells me has been fixed. Our job is to verify that it's been fixed. And not everything was fixed.
Not everything was fixed. And again, I think that we've known Isabel Cumming for a number of years here, right? And I think that she's a reasonable individual. She's not a gotcha She's not, I'm doing this just to get you. It's important because the conditions exist now. If 6 months from now, in the middle of the winter, and they report back, hey, we got that air conditioner fixed. No, that's unacceptable. When we're going through the heat wave that we've been going through, and mind you, we all know how heat works, right? Just because we had a cool day here and there, does that mean, oh, it's nice and cool in the facility? No, the heat is trapped in there. It's going to be hot inside these facilities for a long time. You have to show back up and show a sense of urgency, which is interesting. The sense of urgency should be by the bosses, right? That's who should actually be conveying the sense of urgency. And when I say she's reasonable, if there's progress towards the bigger fixes that might take a little bit more time, but here are the steps that have been taken in the interim, we're not going to be talking about another report. We're going to be updating the fact and updating it with the unions, updating it with the workers. Here's the time frame of when you can expect relief versus why is it still this way? Again, here's more.
The Office of the Inspector General's new report, published on Tuesday morning, found the DPW has been aware of numerous issues since at least March. An engineering firm sending management a report about the Cherry Hill location that listed HVAC issues, bathroom facility issues, and highlighted missing floor tiles. Cummings said during her visits 4 months later, she found many of the same issues persist.
Over half of them had significant air conditioning issues.
And again, this isn't a gotcha. Over 4 months later, this goes back to like last year when you had these pool issues. Why, once the pools are slated to be open, are we having a conversation about the fact that they won't be opening? That could have happened months prior. Why in March, when we're not planning on using the air conditioning and it's pointed out to you, you wait till the middle of July to actually address the issue, which probably won't get taken care of this summer? Why? That's the functionality of government. And again, I speak to the different layers that exist in the government, how we've seen government grow. We've seen the council president's office grow over the years. We've seen the mayor's office grow. We've heard former Mayor Sheila Dixon call in, and she talked about how many people she had under her administration compared to how many exist now. We've watched it grow. You would think growing means more efficiency. The argument that a lot of the people who are against the ballot measure to reduce the council size is we won't be able to provide the level of service to the members of the community the way we do now if we lose council seats and representation. Well, when we can't take care of our workers in the environment with all of these people, why should anyone believe that's accurate? Why? That is precisely the issue. Again, more from WBAL-TV's Tali Taylor.
They had not put the water in the Gator out till they saw me coming.
The day before the new Inspector General report was released, 11 News Investigates caught up with Mayor Brandon Scott at a luncheon for DPW workers.
Well, I think that, listen, we've invested $20 million into DPW facilities, right? We know that both Reaper and Bowley's Lane will get new buildings in the next 2 to 3 years.
No, that's not, in fairness, Mr. Mayor, that's not the right answer. No, it's about empathy. It's not about what you're going to do. It's about what are you going to do right now, not the future. We're talking about, I'm hot right now. So you tell me 2 years from now, you know, when I retired from the Anne Arundel County Police Department, one thing I didn't get a chance to do was enjoy the new police training academy. Never stepped foot in the thing. And they have a new one. If you told me, as I'm about to retire, we got a brand new police academy coming next year, that doesn't mean no good. It's hot right where I am right now. I'm hot right now. I don't care about what you invested for the next year. What are we going to do about right now? What am I hot tomorrow? Do I not get to drink any water tomorrow? What's the scenario for the right now?
Mayor Scott said workers feel comfortable approaching him, asking for his help with facility issues that have been going on for decades.
It doesn't make me happy, of course, but it also showcases why we're making the investments that we're making in our facilities for our workers.
I get it. I get it. It's not a you problem until it is. It becomes a you problem when you assume the office and you have to address it and you have to prioritize. Are there opportunities? And interesting part, some of this are quick fixes. Some of this are clean bottles of water and spaces. Some of this is logistics, literally simple management processes. Who's the logistics person? Is it a write-off? Is it somebody go out and buy the cooler and the ice and put it here? Go out and buy a portable air conditioning unit for this particular facility or whatever the case might be, and we'll reimburse you for it. Is it a logistical thing, or is this something more to it than that of a mismanagement? That's the question. It's not about what we're going to do in the future. It's what can you do for me right now? That's the key. Again, here's more from WBAL-TV's Tyler Taylor.
While he and Cummings see improving DPW working conditions as common ground, Mayor Scott disagreed with one of her findings.
Well, one, I think that, one, I knew that we provide ice and water beforehand. The IG may have just came after that was already given out.
It's just not true. Because I have literally talked to so many people. They did not have ice and water till after our report started.
And again, I have to say that when presented with something like this, it's actually probably best to be a listener and not a talker and just listen to what the issues are and try to resolve them. Because if people are saying we're not getting the service, someone isn't getting the service that was supposedly provided. Somebody dropped the ball, and that needs to be addressed. And that is what the focus should be, in my opinion. Not you don't have to be defensive about this. When I talk about these things, this is not arguably. Again, if I'm the mayor, somebody is getting yelled at. This is similar to the Secret Service director. It ain't my job to go out and buy water. I'm the mayor. I don't think about buying ice. It ain't my job. Somebody dropped the ball. I'm going to find out who and why this problem persists, and I'm going to report back to you, Inspector General, because this is unacceptable by every measure, period. Not going to accept it. Our workers deserve to be treated better than this. The ones who are comfortable coming up to me, talking to me, I appreciate them. There are others that probably don't want to tell me what's actually going on, but thank you for your report. Where you can come back a week later and you can see the results of the conversations that I'm about to have, because this is wholly unacceptable.
And while Cummings says she knows DPW facility issues date back decades, she also remembers when her office raided one DPW location back in 2019.
It has not changed. It has only gotten worse since 2019. I know that firsthand. I was there.
Yeah. A texter brings up a great point. Maybe some of the rescue plan millions should have gone to these maintenance problems. You think about it. Yeah. I kind of laughed because the Patterson Park Pagoda was closed for an extended period of time. And it was, of course, blamed on the pandemic. Why? The outdoor Patterson Park Pagoda at a park. That you could have closed off and one person could have gone there. They didn't do the inspections regularly during COVID. Now, I say that as somebody who's written many grants over the years that you have to relate it back to the grant. So did some things slip through the cracks by virtue of the pandemic and not being able to follow up on things, backlog or whatever, that to your point, Texter, using some of the millions to upfit these places, these units, these agencies, could you have done that? Yes, surely. We'll come back and we continue the conversation. Got somebody in the on-deck circle, Bob, want to get to, and I'll get to you when we return here on the TJ Smith Show.
You can also hear the show live weekdays 10 a.m. to 2 on WBAL News Radio 1090, FM 101.5, and the WBAL Radio app. You're listening to the TJ Smith Podcast.
Welcome back to the show. Before we went to break, we were having a conversation about this DPW report from the Inspector General's office that kind of just showed some of the conditions there haven't improved. And this is like an ongoing thing, which is that's the bigger concern. This is ongoing, and it feels like it could have been addressed over time. And again, I don't think at all that the Inspector General is trying to do a gotcha or anything like that. It's like, hey, it's arguably a dire circumstance, a dire issue that could ultimately result in harming some people through the conditions that they're in, which in turn the city's going to have to pay out money. Before we get to the money, it's the humanity part of this, right? But in turn, the lack of humanity can cost the city money, and that's part of the job of an inspector general to look into this. Go to the phone lines, get Bob in Carroll County. Bob, good afternoon. You're on WBAO.
Hey, good afternoon, TJ. And really, that's what I wanted to talk about is the humanity in this. You and I having both worked police work. Look, we could get back in air-conditioned cars, right? But some of those days were really hot. And these guys, we have to remember, these DPW guys, they're out patching potholes, picking up trash, working with heavy stuff in the hot sun when nobody else can, you know, and they can't even get, they go to the faucet and hot water comes out of all four faucets. Warm water bottles are given to them. There's no ice. The air conditioning's broken except for the supervisors. You got a supervisor, according to the interview, hiding from the inspector general, refusing to come out and speak to the inspector general. You got their subordinates, the mid-level managers, that are told that they cannot talk to the inspector general, who is supposed to be straightening all this stuff out. Will Hanna had a comment this morning on C4 and Brian's show. It was on a totally different topic, but it was about culture. And he called in regarding the juvenile shootings and how we really had to change the culture in order to change that. Well, I think the culture really needs to change in this city. I mean, when you got a health department where it's okay to have a dead rat for 6 months and a health department, it's bigotry comes in so many forms. Mm-hmm. It's the bigotry of low expectation. Mm-hmm. And how can you expect your employees, your lower level, presumably lower paid employees, to perform if the powers that be are not taking care of them? It infuriates me. And I got to tell you, the other counties aren't perfect either, but I just think the expectations are so much lower for everybody in this city when it comes to the educational system and everything else. People just are tired of fighting. They're tired of fighting back. They're giving up. And this is emblematic of that. How can you not give your people water in the middle of the summertime?
When we have a code red really, on top of it.
Exactly. This is just really emblematic of a cultural management problem. People are going to rise to the expectations you set for them as long as those expectations are reasonable. But you know what? If you don't expect enough, they won't do much either. And I think the citizens are just so used to substandard stuff in the city.
You're not surprised by anything. You basically beat people into submission. And thank you for the call as always, Bob. And to further Bob's point, what you also get, again, if you think of the whole waste, fraud, and abuse grows when you feel disrespected, when your morale goes down as an employee. You feel like they aren't taking care of me, so I won't take care of them. And then it starts to pinch in different ways, whether it's sloughing off on the job, leaving a little earlier, taking things that don't belong to you. You have to ask for toilet tissue. I mean, come on. Some of this gets so outrageous that you shouldn't have to deal with this. Again, that's something that we should be working hard to address, that it shouldn't take multiple reports. It shouldn't take a follow-up report on it. That's not what's necessary. It's insane when you think about it. I'll read this text. I get it. It is frustrating when you look at it in its total concept. So we can pay juveniles not to commit crimes, but we can't provide proper air conditioning for our city workers and children trying to learn. Makes sense. And what you're talking about is the stipends that have been paid to, some of the squeegee workers, whatever the case might be. Yeah, that's what makes you compare things like that. You know, again, honestly, I don't care where the money has come from. We could find grant money to do this. Prioritize. Make it right. Make it work. Some of this stuff is easy. Like, if she went back and the only issue was the entire HVAC system has to be replaced. And here is the paper trail of all of the progress that we've made in it. We probably aren't talking about this report. But when we're still talking about the fact that you don't even have fresh ice, fresh water, again, that's a problem. And I say again to the mayor, you don't need to be defensive about that. You need to acknowledge that there's still some workers crying out for help. There's still some workers that don't feel comfortable approaching you and don't feel comfortable telling their boss or whatever. That's the condition that they walked into and that they witnessed. And it's their truth that they are sharing with the governing body that's overseeing this change that's necessary. That's the frustration, I think, for a lot of people. Let's hear from Ed in Baltimore. Ed, if you could turn down your radio, you're on the air.
And I say again, Ed, you don't need to be.
All right, Ed, I'm going to see if my producer can check with you. I'll bring you back. I have to turn down the radio, though. That's part of the big issue, man. People just get frustrated, and it can lead to a demoralized worker, which a demoralized worker in turn ultimately is an unproductive worker, and it just turns the quality work that you might be trying to do, things that you're trying to accomplish, it just turns it into something that it doesn't need to be. The ingredients are there. Again, there are a lot of people who work in environments that might not be the very best, right? But they get taken care of by their supervision. They get taken care of by their employer, and they go through the wall for them. They go through the wall for them because they know that the person cares about them. And if we project that we kind of don't care, that's the results you're going to get. It's unfortunate. It really is. When we come back, got an update on this investigation into the assassination attempt. I mean, the fails are outrageous. They get more egregious by the minute, it seems. We'll come back and give you an update on that when we return here to TJ Smith.
Insight and perspective on the key issues in Baltimore. This is the TJ Smith Podcast on WBAL.com.
And a very good morning. Happy hump day to you, Baltimore. TJ Smith here on the TJ Smith Show on WBAL News Radio 1090 and FM 101.5. I want to jump right into it. I am pleased to be joined by the reigning manager of the year. That is our Baltimore Orioles manager, Brandon Hyde. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, sir. I want to get into this really quickly with you. Last night, we saw what looked on television to be a pretty bad injury to Jorge Mateo. Any updates on him at this hour?
No, not yet. Yeah, not yet. He's still getting further tests. It didn't look good. I'm trying to stay optimistic about it, but it's I don't know. The X-rays were negative, and went to go get an MRI last night. We're kind of waiting for the results on that.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep him in our thoughts. And Al Suarez, is he in much better shape, obviously, than Jorge? We expect him to get back pretty soon.
Yeah, no, he just got hit in the shin, and that's painful at the moment. But it's just like a shin bruise.
All right. Again, we're speaking with Orioles manager Brandon Hyde. So another big move coming tonight. We'll see a young star, Chase McDermott, or at least a young star in the making, we all hope. What's it like for you as the manager of this team with all of this young talent? You've been through some things. You had to go through this team and the losing seasons while some of these young people started developing. Now you're getting a chance to see a number of them. What's it like in a person like Chase McDermott coming up to start tonight? What's that like for you, sir?
Well, no, it's exciting. Yeah, we have high hopes for a lot of these guys, and you know, Chase came over to us from a trade, and he's got a really good fastball. He's got great stuff. So it's his turn right now, and we're looking forward to watching him pitch tonight.
Indeed. So how involved are you when it comes to call-ups or trades? We know the trade deadline's coming up next week. Do you get involved with that, or do you focus more on the X's and O's of the game? How is your involvement in that?
That's mainly the front office and Mike Elias. That's their focus right now. My focus is on the team currently, the 26 guys we have, our 40-man roster. Now, that being said, Mike does, you know, keep me in the loop, and he lets me know what's happening from the conversations that he's having with people around the league or possible trade targets. And we'll have conversations about that. But when it comes to the execution of the deal or making a decision on stuff when it comes to trade deadline, that's Mike and his team.
Yeah. Do you ever happen to urge him, say, hey, could use another arm, that would help me out a great deal? Do you ever urge him, say, hey, you know, if you got a couple extra dollars?
Well, that's a little bit of a tricky subject, but yeah, I think he's very aware of where I think that we could be upgraded in certain positions.
Indeed. And what areas do you think you would like to see potential upgrades in? If you can answer, I get it.
Yeah, no, that's a more of a private conversation, and we're happy with a lot of the guys that we have on this club, and I think everybody's looking to improve their club at the deadline, and so we'll see what happens.
All right, so attendance. Baltimore led the majors in the biggest attendance boost year over year, 27% attendance boost. We can certainly use more people there. But what does that feel like? Can you feel the difference as you've gone through the several years? You had to go through the weird year of 2020, of course, without any fans. But what's that feeling like? Can you feel that difference of 27% more people at the stadium this year than last?
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely you can. There's definitely a different buzz in the crowd, and I'm really happy that our players are getting to experience, you know, winning crowd, winning what winning feels like. We've done that for a couple of years now, and you've seen it seems like there's more and more fans every series we go home. So we've been fortunate to have incredible fans in Baltimore. We love when they come out. We love when the place is full and loud, and we've had that quite a few times this year.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Again, we're speaking to Orioles manager Brandon Hyde. Let me ask you, now, the Ravens had this 20-something game win streak in the preseason, and some people thought it was goofy. Some people were like, oh, it's great, and it finally ended last year, and we moved on. This year, the series streak was over or ended, but it was last year during the playoffs against Texas that it kind of unofficially ended. It was the playoffs. What did you learn during that series? I've been talking about it a lot on the radio over the past year or so. I said battle-tested, y'all are more battle-tested this year. How would you describe your team and the resiliency after last year's playoff loss?
Well, that was a really tough series, and we ran into kind of a buzzsaw. I thought a little bit of inexperience kind of showed. I thought guys were trying to do maybe a little bit too much in Texas. Just came off of beating Tampa in two games and, you know, swung the bat extremely well. They were kind of lined up. Unfortunately for us, we had 5 days off and came out a little stale, I feel like. But, you know, they ended up rolling through and winning the World Series. So, you know, we ran into kind of the wrong team at the wrong moment. You know, hopefully we can get back to the playoffs this year. Hopefully we play a little bit better. But yeah, I mean, this is playoff experience is something you only get if you're in the playoffs. Mm. And a lot of our guys hadn't experienced that, and now they have, and hopefully they'll use that to know what the experience is like going forward.
Yeah, and with that, what are you doing down this stretch to keep the arms fresh in particular? We have, you know, the pitching rotation is what it is, a lot of unfortunate injuries, but how are you keeping these arms fresh as we go down this home stretch?
Well, you do the best you can, but every game is different. You know, I had to take the starter out in the third inning last night. Mm. So you go in with a game plan, do your best you can to communicate with the pitchers, with the training staff, with the pitching coaches on where guys are physically, who could use a little bit more of a rest than others. But injuries are going to happen. Injuries do happen. We've had our share of pitching injuries so far this year. I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that we don't have any the rest of the way.
Yeah, and again, and finally, I want to say thank you on behalf of Baltimore fans who bleed orange through and through for getting ejected in the Yankees game. You can fight the Yankees anytime. I'm not endorsing any violence, but what a moment that was. Where did that frustration come from? Did you think that they intentionally threw at Heston?
Well, I don't think that they did on that in that moment. I think that there was some buildup from the series before where I thought we handled things extremely professionally. I think that sometimes in competitive moments, there's emotion takes over a little bit, and you know, it was a scary moment. Has to get hit in the head, and you know, I thought, you know, I let my emotions maybe get the best of me at that time.
No, we were okay with it. We were okay with
but
it.
But sometimes those things happen, and you know, you move on.
Yeah, well, indeed. I know you have to get out of here. Congrats on being Manager of the Year. And another congratulations, your daughter graduated from Syracuse last year. I know a lot of Syracuse alum. I wear orange and blue often, and some people, because I'm hanging out with the Syracuse alum, often ask me, was I alum? I wasn't, but I know a lot of people that are. So congrats to you on your achievements, and best of luck for the remainder of this year.
Oh, that's really nice of you to say. I really, really, really appreciate it. Yeah, and she's here with me right now.
Oh, congrats. So, there she is, the orange alum.
Yeah, she's enjoying a little Miami time right now, which it's a lot of fun to be with her for the series. So yeah, thanks again for the what you said.
Excellent, and have a great rest of the season. Appreciate your time. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much for having me on. Appreciate it.
All right, again, that's Orioles manager Brandon Hyde, who joined us this morning. And you know, last night, if you were watching the Orioles game or listening right here on WBAL, you heard early in the game the significant injury to Jorge Mateo. Now, what we know about Jorge Mateo is that the X-rays were negative. And I don't want to sit here and play doctor. I don't want to do that, but I guess I'm going to try. You know, I'm a person who's broken a bone before. I'm a person who's torn two Achilles tendons as well. So with the X-ray being negative, that's basically, I believe, tells us his arm is not broken. But the MRI could indicate tendon damage potentially. And the way that arm flexed, they're probably bracing for that eventuality, and that's an unfortunate injury. If you think about people who've broken bones in whatever sport, baseball, football, certain places, a wrist break is sometimes very difficult to recover from because of the small fragments and everything else. Look at me, I'm really playing doctor here. But the wrist breaks, you know, some ankle breaks, they take longer to heal, but some of them are clean. And within a couple of months, you're back to normal. But when you injure a tendon, when you injure a muscle, like, again, we see these Achilles tendon injuries. You saw Aaron Rodgers' first game, first 4 seconds or whatever it was of last season. Done. Gone. A year out. Where a break, you can make a return sooner. So sometimes, you know, you might have seen, oh, wow, he broke his arm. A broken arm sometimes could be better in a bizarre way than a tendon tear. Now, the possibility exists that it could be a sprain or strain or what have you, and that could bode well perhaps for a comeback around playoff time. And hopefully he doesn't need surgery for whatever the injury is, because he's a dynamic player. When he gets on the bases, if it's a walk, if it's a single, you know that the possibility exists that he's going to round those bases by stealing. Or if it's a hit into the gap and he's on first base, he's likely going to score. He's a game changer. And having somebody like him on this team, well, I had high hopes for. He was a early draft pick for the New York Yankees when he first came into the league, and they had high hopes for him, and then the Orioles landed him. He's not always the strongest bat in the world. He's not going to hit 300 or what have you, but he is a good glove, a really great glove at that, and a dynamic speedster for this Oriole team. Al Suarez, another find by this team. He unfortunately got injured last night and had to leave early, but hopefully he will be back in a period of time where he's able to assist this team down the stretch. Now, you heard the skipper. I will say, I think he was a lot more candid than you've seen in the past, where he basically said, yeah, hopefully we get some type of trade. I'm paraphrasing. He didn't say it in those exact words. But he kind of alluded to the fact that, yeah, there are some needs. I like most of what we have, but we can use a little something. And look, that's an honest answer. We know that we can use some upgrades. You can like your guys. You can like the people you have, but you know you can use a few people that can be helpful and help boost what you have with the team. So hopefully we see some type of trade moving forward that's beneficial to this Oriole team as we go down the stretch. I could also tell from the conversation that it's still stinging, that loss from the Texas series last year. But I also think, and I think we talked about it here on the show, if you've been following us, you know, I talked about it here on the show, how last year this team wasn't battle tested. They were young. And I think, I have to admit, I think I had a pretty good analysis. I said I felt like they were trying to do too much. That inexperience of wanting to be the one that saves the day or whatever. And that's exactly what the manager conveyed, that they might have been pressing. It's their first time under those lights. And now you can settle down under those lights. And perhaps you're the team that's going to go in this year and be able to come out with different results. And I think that's what we all hope for. So sticking with the and by the way, I don't know about you, but I enjoyed every minute of him going after the Yankees. Anytime you have an opportunity, and I'm not endorsing violence, it's all in fun for sports or whatever, but it's always nice to clear the benches against the Yankees team because, you know, if you're a real Baltimorean, you're supposed to hate the Yankees. That's just the way it goes. And it's always nice to beat up on them literally and figuratively. But again, I'm not endorsing any violence, but that was good. Oh, and another note in Baltimore sports, I think my concern, not that I'm concerned about the year, but Lamar Jackson, I would anticipate he's going to miss practice again today. That's 3 days now in a row that he's missed practice. Now, I also want to be fair because it's possible he has things going on that we are all unaware of that we shouldn't, pass judgment on him because we don't know. Apparently, whatever he's dealing with is serious enough that he had to miss 3 days in a row. And if you think about it from a sickness standpoint, if you've ever had to call out of work for three consecutive days, one, you need to bring a doctor's note, right, when you come back. But you're usually really sick. And I'm wishing him the very best in his recovery. But I think, and I say this as a cautionary tale, Chadwick Boseman, remember he was ill. Now, and again, wouldn't wish this on anybody, wouldn't even compare it. But when he was ill, he kept it private. And as he went through his debilitating state, people were talking about him losing weight and how he looked bad and everything else. Then he died. And people felt bad because of the way they were chastising what he looked like. And no indication that Lamar has anything close to that. But we might not know that he's dealing with something that he can live with, but it causes him to miss work. Because this has been a continuous theme where we've seen him out for just random reasons over the years, and it's been sicknesses. So that possibility exists. That's kind of where my head goes. So I'm literally wishing Lamar Jackson the very best. And when he gets back on the field, I don't think anybody's going to think back to these days. But, of course, it is absolutely a question. When we come back, we'll get back into some of our normal show, talking to all things Baltimore and nationally as well. Got a few things to get into. Of course, we'll get into some of the national election stuff, but a lot of local things to get into, including this GVRS conversation. A long-form article in the Baltimore Brew. I want to kind of break down because it kind of gets into some of what I've been talking about, plus some more on education. We'll get into that when we return here on the TJ Smith Show.
You can also hear the show live weekdays 10 a.m. to 2 on WBAL News Radio 1090, FM 101.5, and the WBAL radio app. You're listening to the TJ Smith Podcast.
All right, welcome back to the show. TJ Smith here. And the Group Violence Reduction Strategy is a signature strategy by the mayor's office, managed by the Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement, better known as MONSEE. And, you know, we've talked about it for a number of years, of course. It's been something that's rolled out, and we saw it initially tested over in West Baltimore. Apparently, the success was good enough that they wanted to roll it out. And arguably, it was probably going to be rolled out no matter what the results were. And when you do tests like this, you have to go back and evaluate them to see what works, what doesn't work, how you can do it better. That's why I look at whatever the successes we've had over the past now year and a half, how do we multiply those? We have to go back and assess ourselves and be honest with ourselves. We can't, you know, try to flower this thing up because it's politically advantageous. It could be simply great that we're having reductions coupled with a strategy that, you know, it could or couldn't be working, but we like that we're able to target some enforcement in areas and on certain people, as well as target some resources to certain people. I'm going to say it off the top. It is hard pressed for me to buy in to the person on the street that's a would-be killer, would-be shooter, who gets the opportunity at counseling, at a job, and that's the point, the pivotal point that their life changed. I'm basing that on personal experiences, and I would also encourage you, if you're one of the people out there, we have these conversations in the past, when we've had them in the past, some of you have called in and said, you know, I was on the wrong side of the tracks, and the defining moment for me was this. And I know we talked about it a bit last week where I said it as well. I've talked to individuals who changed their lives around, and it normally is a significant moment, much more than, you know, government came around and said, hey, you either going to jail or you going to take this job and this training. It's more significant than that. It's, I went in front of the judge and the judge spared me the 20-year prison sentence she was about to give me, or he was about to give me. You know, I went to jail for 20 years and I got out on good behavior or whatever. And I'm like, I'm not going back. My friend was killed right in front of me, and somehow they spared me. And I said, I can't do this any longer. Sometimes you age out where it just gets old. But to think that some government intervention of programming is the main reason. And I want to be clear. I'm also not discounting some of the programming, because some of the programming can help those who haven't gone that far. So it's a difference when you're dealing with perhaps some delinquency, some low-level crimes, yeah, you can probably have better success at getting them to turn in a different direction than the person who's already jumped off the cliff, basically. And they already know what they're capable of doing, and it's going to take a whole lot more. So this article examines, a long-form article examining the GVRS, the Group Violence Reduction Strategy. Now, jump off right off the top. I mean, again, when I said we have to have an honest conversation, they've always said this. It said the group is defined as three or more people that have a propensity to commit gun violence with or for each other. That is Jack French, the spokesperson for Monsey. The definition of a gang is an organized group of criminals. And that's basically what he just described. Let's just call it what they are. A lot of this is gang related. And you could call it a group, you call it a gang, call it a posse, you call it whatever you want. They're a group of people who are furthering their criminality through their activities, through violence. And that's what a gang is. So let's start on the foundation that we do have organized groups that are carrying out violence in certain territories, certain geographies, for whatever reason. It doesn't have to be Bloods and Crips. It doesn't have to be Treetop Piru or any of that stuff. It doesn't have to be Latin Kings. It's a group of people. They can call themselves whatever they want, and they're carrying it out for the purpose of criminality. That's what you have. So as we look at this, they go in it and talk about the GVRS model of this carrot and stick model. I actually get tired of hearing about that. But they promise access to social services while charging people, often many at once, in alleged criminal groups. gangs. Okay. The program involves federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. They say in the article, similar focused deterrence was tried twice before in Baltimore and failed. It was deployed in the 1990s before it was shut down by Mayor Martin O'Malley. It returned in 2014 when there were 211 homicides, only to unravel by 2017 due to a lack of social services and law enforcement buy-in. That year, there were 343 homicides. The interesting part about this article that goes into great detail about some of the statistics and all, it fails to mention one big thing that happened in 2015. You might know, if you do know, this is a $100 Jeopardy question. You can let me know. But yeah, one big thing happened in 2015 that shot the numbers up. Also, something that wasn't brought up in this article that I take issue with is we had a prosecutorial philosophy change. It's also interesting to think in 2011, when they tout the fact that things were going great, there was a different prosecutorial philosophy. And it was interesting that that race in that year was actually about it being too violent in Baltimore. And the following year, and again, something big happened in 2015 in Baltimore, we saw murders shoot up. So you, when you have people that are from outside of Baltimore that that might study this, they also might not look at the things that were happening in the city. And part of that comes out. So I'm going to get into that as well. Again, you could join in on the conversation if you have any thoughts on what might have caused the reduction in violent crime. I know a lot of people want to say State's Attorney Ivan Bates, but when I go through some of the other cities, again, there could be phenomenons other than Ivan Bates. No doubt that that's a part of it, just as well as some can be part of this group violence reduction strategy. Let me get Bob in here in Parkville. Bob, good morning. You're on WBAL.
How are you doing, TJ?
I'm great. Thank you.
I forgot to congratulate you when I called last week about you making the honorable mention in the Sun's Best of Baltimore for a radio talk host.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Thank you very much. Yeah, I should have campaigned for it, but thank you.
Anyway, I think Ivan Bates' election has a lot to do with what's happened. I know it's going down in other cities and all. But really, until he got there and we had a serious effort to stop the crime and his partnership with the U.S. attorney, I think is a huge factor. I mean, the other things you mentioned, I'm sure there are factors also. But you mentioned 2015. I assume you're talking about the Freddie Gray riots.
Oh, where's my C4 bell? Ding, ding, ding. Yes, you get it. I mean, that's the easiest. But it's not even mentioned. You can't have an honest conversation about the spike in violence in Baltimore City without mentioning the riots and without mentioning the prosecutor at the time. You can't do it. It just it leaves a gaping hole in the reality. That's like going to the doctors and not telling them all your symptoms and thinking that you're going to get cured based on the symptoms you decided to tell them. I mean, it's not you're not being fair to yourself or to all of us. It's just not fair.
Yeah, I was watching TV at the time, and I could see what was going to happen. And I'm wondering, why didn't they close that Douglas High School? Why didn't they stem the thing before it started? Well, we remember who the mayor was at the time, so it's really not a shock.
Yeah, I appreciate it as always, Bob, and thank you again. Appreciate you. Look, I don't want to relitigate the riots of 2015, but yeah, some moments in time that could have changed the history of Baltimore for sure. But again, we go back and you can look at a number of things. Yeah, everybody's getting the question right. Everybody knows what happened in 2015. It's the, glaring issue. How, when you talk about the sustained violence in Baltimore and the big reductions we see, and you want to, and I'm going to get into this in just a minute because I want to, Jeff Asher, who I've communicated with a number of times, is a data analyst and consultant. He, one of his reports, he talked about murder being down 20.5% in 103 cities with available data through at least January. It was down 20% 6.2% in 174 cities with data available through at least February, and down 20.8% in 59 cities with data available through at least March 20th of this year. These declines, according to Asher's report, follow a larger, potentially even historically large decline in 2023. We've talked about that a lot, that we've seen that. And it's one of the things that I thought that then candidate President Joe Biden wasn't emphasizing enough as he was out, whether it's campaigning or even at the debate. Again, you don't have to agree. And I said the same thing for Mayor Scott when he was going through the election. It doesn't matter if you think he deserves credit or not. He's in office presiding over these reductions, so he's going to get credit. And that's what you should do. You should take credit. But I think we should have an honest conversation about how it was achieved, because if it were to happen again, shouldn't you be able to quickly go back to what was successful to tamp it down if that were to happen? We've seen the ebbs and flows of violence, and that's like my bigger issue. And again, watching gun violence and the shootings and murders go down, it's been dramatic in the in cities across America. In 2023, Detroit saw its lowest number of murders in 57 years. Again, we're talking a lot about what we're seeing and experiencing here in Baltimore because we're here and we've dealt with it. But other cities are also realizing significant reductions. How did they get there? If Detroit isn't employing a group violence reduction strategy, perhaps is there some other phenomenon, which I don't know if we can answer. I don't know what it is. I don't know what happened. I don't know why all of a sudden from the murderous 2020 to where we are today. Is it because we've focused on a lot more people? One thing that's not in this article as well is the U.S. attorney and the different operations that were deployed to some of the most violent cities in America, Baltimore being one of those cities that got the strategy deployment of using that, quote, Al Capone methodology of going after the most violent offenders. Murders in Philadelphia dropped by 21%. 2024 has continued the success. As of late June in New Orleans, murder rates are 44% lower than what they were in 2023. That's interesting because Baltimore is probably somewhere lower than that number, but still significant. But think about that. Again, the same conversations. 410-467-WBAL, 410-467-9225 on the Pizza Bowlies text line. I feel like when some of the people nationally want to talk a bit more about Baltimore, when they're asked from a publication in Baltimore, they feel like they have to say it's different how it's happening here. I don't know why. I don't know why it would be different what's happening here than what's happening in New Orleans. New Orleans historically has been violent. We've seen it. They went through a major tragedy in 2005, of course, and they saw an uptick in violence even with a less population, right? Because there was a lot of instability, a lot of corruption in the police department as well there at the time. So Rob Wilcox, who we had on the show, the deputy director of the Biden administration's Office of Gun Violence Prevention, said that the violence reduction is happening everywhere, but it's happening with the most acceleration in places like Baltimore. Once again, when we talked about this over the years, I've talked about it historically. If you go back and you look at some before we saw these reductions, a lot of people want to compare us to 2020. And that's when other cities saw the dramatic increases post George Floyd murder. They saw the dramatic increases. We were still within it. So we didn't really bump up any. We just stayed at the levels we were. And then finally, in 2023, we started the gradual pullback of these numbers. And I say gradual, was actually a very steep pullback of these violence numbers. So, again, the other data analyst, Jeff Asher, he said, unlike other cities, Baltimore didn't experience a surge in violence in 2020. Well, that's my point. When somebody's not necessarily here, we didn't experience a surge in violence in 2020 because ours happened 5 years prior in 2015, and we just sustained those levels. If you look at the data again, Chicago, when they had some challenges with their police department to deal with some more, again, one of the Illinois, not Chicago PD, but a suburban Chicago police department, where they were releasing tapes of unarmed people being killed, unarmed black men mainly being killed by police officers, they saw the increase in murders there. So you started watching it happen in cities, St. Louis, after the situation with Michael Brown there. We saw it happening there. It just simply happened widespread in 2020 when George Floyd was murdered. That is what put everyone else on the pace. But again, he says this. So he talked about in 2014, there were 211 homicides, followed by 344 in 2015. And he talks about the murder rate of where it was, increasing from 33.8 to 55.2 per 100,000. In 2022, there were 333 murders with a murder rate of 56.8. Again, watching the population, unfortunately, for Baltimore decline, saw the murder rate tick up a bit. And what he ultimately said, Jeff Asher, the data analyst here, I would say that you'd most likely be seeing a decline with or without new strategies. But Baltimore has kind of been this exception. You can't prove the counterfactual. You can make the argument that maybe we wouldn't have seen a decline without the new strategies. I'm still up in the air about that. What do you think? 410-467-WBAL, 410-467-9225 on the Pizza Bullies text line. I got more in this article. Come back and talk about it. Do you think it was more of a strategy-based thing? And what more can we do with this strategy if it is, in fact, working? What can we do to address some of the violence that still persists in our communities? We'll come back, continue the conversation here on the TJ Smith Show.
This is the TJ Smith Podcast on WBAL.com and the WBAL radio app.
Yeah, so it's a strange world here in 2024. We hadn't had an assassination attempt on a U.S. president since 1981. And if you think back to the 1970s and 80s, there were a few assassination attempts of presidents back then, 60s, 70s, and 80s, of course. And we hadn't had one in 40-plus years. But think of, again, 2024 in this world of hyper news and so much going on. We are so far past that. But, of course, the hearings are still taking place to try to figure out what's happening when it comes to what occurred. One thing I missed over the past several days, I don't know if you saw it or missed it as well, but the shooter had a drone. The shooter actually had a drone. You know, it was in his car, but I wonder if it was used at any point, because it says that he flew the drone over the rally before the shooting. I actually, you know, it's crazy. I didn't know about this. And yesterday, I think, was when we talked about it with the Secret Service director getting relieved of her duties. When we talked about this on yesterday, I brought up the fact that the Ravens game was delayed because of a drone. The Ravens game was delayed because of a drone. And you mean to tell me we have a former U.S. president and a presidential candidate speaking with Secret Service protection, and a drone was able to go overhead and it wasn't shot down? I mean, that's actually a UFO at that point, right? You don't know what that thing is capable of. You might have had eyes on it, but for something like that to happen, that in and of itself seems like a security breach as well. So more information is coming out about this would-be assassin. The FBI director, Chris Wray, who's still testifying as we speak at Capitol Hill, he told lawmakers that a laptop tied to the Trump rally gunman included a Google search of how far away was Oswald from Kennedy. The search references Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, who shot and killed President Kennedy back in 1963. I mean, again, it's wild because we still haven't found out what was his reasoning and were there other targets. Potentially, we've heard that he also had looked at the Democratic National Convention. Was this a moment of opportunity that he just took? But if you think about it, things like this, I mean, I'm guessing, but we've seen other events in the past. Of course, not an assassination attempt of a president, but did this all just happen in a vacuum, or did he scope this out leading up to this? Did he know there was going to be a rally? Did he go out and figure it out, or did he just show up and say, oh, I can go up on that roof? Is that what happened? I mean, again, this is really, really a wild situation. They say just hours before opening fire, the gunman in the attempted assassination flew a drone roughly 200 yards from the rally stage where the former president was going to be talking. So he was able to live stream some footage, which, again, I hadn't heard of about that a couple of days ago when apparently it first came out. They recovered the drone and the controller from the suspect's car, and they're still analyzing it as we speak. But, I mean, even then, it's like it seems like no one knew anything prior to. And we know leading up to this event that this you're looking at some of the you're seeing some of the footage. Chuck Grassley, the senator, released some footage of the Secret Service and local authorities talking to one another, ironically, on the roof after this incident took place. It's so many questions, and I think this is exactly why. She had to step down. This is exactly why the FBI, I mean, I'm sorry, the Secret Service director had to step down. And you know, this is precisely why the gaps in this were crazy. And is it complacency? But this is also what breeds the conspiracy theories. I mean, again, I still don't believe there's some major conspiracy theory, but the reality of it is, this is what breeds it, because you almost can't believe somebody that a Secret Service organization could be this ill prepared. You just almost can't believe it. Matt texted that there was an attempt on George Bush and Georgia in 2007, someone threw a grenade at him for some reason. It didn't go off. I do not remember that. I remember the shoes getting thrown at him, but I do not remember a grenade being thrown at him. Cindy in Elkridge said, I have not heard mention of why his parents allowed him to have a gun, and they were counselors. Yeah, you know, to your point, yes, the parents are some people that are going to absolutely need to be looked into a little bit more, because the question goes to, you know, we heard what Congressman Raskin was asking at the hearing the other day, but, you know, we got on the AR-15 and the gun situation. It's more about how was he allowed to, why did the parents feel that he should be allowed to possess a gun, not in their presence or whatever. I haven't heard much more about his mental state. I think people were kind of looking at it more all the videos that are surfacing from his time in school and all, and we're hearing about him being bullied and everything else. We're hearing all of that stuff. But again, how is this possible? How was this failure allowed to occur? Yes, both his parents were in that social work field. That's a big issue. That is a big issue. Nobody knew about him because he had no digital footprint. No, hard to track him if they don't know he exists. And I'm not suggesting anyone in law enforcement should have necessarily known about him, but you can ask the question that there was no indication that he had some sort of tendency or propensity towards a particular violence. And it might not. He might not have. It's very, very possible. But he might not have had it. The grenade story. I have to look that up again, because thank you, Kevin. I can't pronounce the guy's name, but you should have spelled that for me a little differently there, Kevin. But I have to look that one up again. But again, if you think back on whatever that story was, I can't tell you who the Secret Service director was at the time, because whatever the issue was, it was apparently resolved enough. And Was it still a security lapse that a grenade got that close to the president, whether it went off or not? I mean, again, of course, it didn't go off, so lucky you, right? But boy, oh boy, this is going to be an interesting story. Some more people are also going to, fall because of this, and we should hear more about this in the coming days.
The TJ Smith Podcast, WBAL.com and the WBAL radio app.